So welcome everyone, welcome. It's nice to have people feel located at our center here, and I hope you find as our events become more common during the day and in the evenings that you come to many of the events. In a few weeks we'll have something happening almost every night of the week. For a while. So a lot of other special times, just be aware of them. Watch our website and our calendar on our website for periodic updates as to what we're going to be doing throughout the week. So tonight I want to start off a little bit differently and then move into the talk, which is on the quiet heart. But I was reading some disparaging news about climate change, as I'm sure that many of you have seen that, where it's prophesied by some scientists now that basically there's no reversing it. It's kind of inevitably moving in an altered direction. And I was thinking, okay, so what's going on here? What is happening in the forces of the world in terms of the quality of consciousness? Because sometimes catastrophes have the opposite effect of discouragement and despair. They actually are areas of uplift and compassion. And if you've ever read some of the stories about how communities form within disasters are very high-spirited and heartfelt communities, neighbor helping neighbor. And you see that under the most trying times, the best of us comes out, is elevated. And of course, I'm hoping that that's the beginning of this evolution of change that we are all going through in terms of climate. I did read something that picked me up a little bit in terms of that evolution of consciousness. I'd just like to read it to you. This on the New York Times. It says, Americans' certainty that the Earth is warming has increased over the past 3 years, and those who think global warming is not happening have become substantially less sure of their position. Falsification and denial, while still all too extensive, have come to require more defensive psychic energy and political chicanery. The climate swerve is mostly a matter of deepening awareness. While exploring the nuclear threat, I distinguished between the fragmentary awareness, consisting of images that come and go but remain tangential, and formed awareness, which is more structured part of the narrative that can be the basis for individual and collective action. With both the nuclear and climate threats, the swerve in awareness has had a crucial ethical component. People come to feel that it was deeply wrong, perhaps evil, to engage in nuclear war, and are coming to an awareness that it is equally deeply wrong and perhaps evil to destroy our habitat and create a legacy of suffering for our children and grandchildren. So there's an evolution going on. There's a when denial is unfrozen, when people shift and become aware of the problem, they become more conscious. And when that consciousness reaches a threshold, then of course that's the availability of compassion to come flooding in. The problem also, of course, is that as consciousness starts to evolve into deeper and more enlightened areas, so too is a shadow that has held that consciousness at bay with resistance and angst, fear. That also rises, and those two forces of the shadow in the persona are very evident in our lives today, in our political life, in our social and economic lives, in the lives of the newspapers and that you can read daily. But I do think that there's a sense now that something, the consciousness is moving in a positive direction, driven by the forces that we have been neglecting. And if you think about how you came into the Dharma, quite likely there was a moments of trauma in your life where you had nowhere else to turn, and those crises of your life formed a readiness to hear information that was deeper and richer. I'm hoping that as a collective that can also happen, that as a collective, as a society, as a world, when pushed strongly in a very negative, despairing direction, that we will be searching then for answers beyond the obvious answers or the conditioned answers that we've grown up with. In that case, the Dharma will be overworked in the years ahead. So even though we hear discouraging news, I think in terms of Dharma and evolution, that it may have a positive direction that comes to bear from it, which is often the case. So I wanted to just say that because when I was reading the reports of climate change today, I felt the discouragement. Initially I thought, oh, you know, but there's also something else that's going on here that is in a positive direction we also need to acknowledge. Okay, so let me now open the talk up to the subject at hand, which is the quiet heart. And very much has to do with the forces that come to bear within the evolution of consciousness. Well, how does consciousness actually change from the squabbling struggles and partial divisiveness that we freeze life and act from life? How does this evolve out of that particular mold and model into an evolutionary wholeness, into an evolutionary quietude? And that's what I would like to speak about tonight. And I would like to go about it whenever we're talking about something as substantial, an experience that's a very substantial, silence, although it doesn't contain anything that you could point to and say, oh, you know, beware of that. It holds a lot. Silence has been invested with a lot of our conditioning. And we should know what conditioning we have when we bring a subject deliberately to bear. And this is certainly one that we need to be aware of what we bring to it. So when we just say silence, what conditioning arises within you? Well, silence can mean many things. It can mean hostility. Somebody is silent. There can be a hostility within that silence, a tension, a force that comes to bear. It can mean distance. When two people are silent, not speaking in communication, there can be this psychic distance that's imparted because of what they're not saying. It can be restraint. It can mean restraint. It can mean waiting, you know, where you're just sort of biding your time till whatever it is that you're trying to be patient changes. And so that silence can also be a form of restraint. It can be a disagreement, you know, that I'm biting my tongue so that I won't react in anger. It can mean consent. When you're silent, when somebody says something you don't have anything to offer, you may in fact consent to what is being said, agree with what's being said. It can mean confusion, meaning I don't know what to say, I don't know what to ask, I'm confused by what's just said, and so I just remain silent. So silence can hold all of those different conditioning. And when we talk about silence in relationship to meditation, you can be sure that some of those conditioned ways that we have invested in that word come up for us as we sit silently. Especially if your family of origin had a particular way in which silence was used, that can be very predominant within your meditation practice. Now we also need to know how the culture itself holds that word. And may I say, not very well. Because really the cultural imperative is to be distracted, is to distract ourselves, not to rest within the silence, but to stay engaged with some form of intensity or entertainment that keeps the whole economic wheel moving. And if we are quiet enough, we'll start asking questions, and those questions inevitably lead to the questions about what we're doing or why we're doing it, which are questions that dismantle the economic wheel, don't drive it. So you can see that as a culture, we stay in somewhat disagreeable relationship with the word silence. Now, from just taking the word on, it appears that quiet or silence should be quite friendly. It should be a word that is kind of benign and that it's useful. And so when we start looking at the word silence and we start looking at that in terms of us sitting within it, it's not so friendly, because it shows us what we are or what we have become in our life. Immediately when we sit down and we are quiet, what happens is that we see where we are. We see the disposition, we see our immediate emotions that are rising and the thought swirls of and thinking that's occurring. We see our agreements and disagreements, we see our irritations and annoyances. We see the disposition of our body and the aches and pains within that. And what it does then is it takes us right into the present moment, which contains all of this different, often confusing bits of information about who we are, who we wish to be, who we thought we were going to be at this age of our life, on and on. So silence, just in sitting, is a word that we have an ambiguous relationship with. And yet, the whole of the Dharma is driven by this word. I hope we all realize that everything in the Dharma, everything we're moving towards, everything we're doing, really has a relationship with silence. And I'll be talking about that, but I want us to get a sense of that. It's very important to understand the direction that spiritual practice takes us. As I mentioned a few weeks ago, that I think is a very good exercise for us all. If you want to see where and how much silence you can hold, simply allow yourself to relax and don't stop the relaxation. Release the psychic tension in your head, in your brain, and all the resistances that you might conceive as you move through different levels of experience, and just keep surrendering to a deeper sense of relaxation. What most of us find is there's a halting point where we will refuse to go any further, where we refuse to allow ourselves to get more quiet. See, when we relax, we're relaxing the noise, ourselves out of the noise, out of the struggle, out of the contentiousness of our life. That's which is held by relaxation. All the struggle is held within the stressors of our life, or within the sense of resistance that we carry with us. So when we start relaxing, we're relaxing that away. We are being silent to that resistance, and we're moving through it. And so as we relax, we get quieter. And as we get quieter, most of us will find that there's a level of fear that quietness brings. And thereby, you can begin to sense where it is that you create yourself. It's a little bit like a small hole in the balloon, right? When you're relaxing, the balloon's full and it starts getting smaller and smaller. And then, as it leaks air, we worry that we're not being fulfilled, that we're not being completely inflated, so we blow more air into the balloon so that we keep ourselves inflated the entire time. And whenever we're silent, the air goes out of the balloon, and whenever we're noisy, air comes into the balloon. And the point from most of our sense of individuality is to keep that balloon as full as possible, to keep it inflated. So I know my disposition to things, I know where I am, I know who I am, I know my circumstances. And so we're constantly creating the noise of our life to keep ourselves sort of in charge of that life. And that, of course, means that we have to constantly work towards blowing that balloon up. And we're good at it. We're so good at it that even when we're sleeping, the damn air comes into the balloon. Which is quite remarkable, really. I think perhaps in deep sleep, some of the air gets lost in the balloon. But for the most part, we're creating just enough noise to keep ourselves inflated for much of our sleep. And so this sense of keeping ourselves full, keeping ourselves away from the silence, keeping ourselves boistered and inflated is really the job of our egoic job. And we do so. But then you begin to realize that the direction that Dharma takes, and ultimately our spiritual home, is in the deflation of that balloon, not the inflation. That the heart, the compassion, the real connectedness can't be found with a full balloon. If you try to find compassion through a lot of thought, through a lot of activity, through a lot of effort and forceful energy, you'll find that it's an abstract compassion that you're relating to, not the real compassion, not the compassion of true connectedness. And I was reading another article, a book by a psychologist, social psychologist from MIT, and she was talking about the world of technology and how the world of technology does just that. That it creates an intermediary between ourselves and true connection, because you're, you know, emailing, or and that sense of intrusion upon that direct connection robs the heart of what it needs in order to feel the compassion and love which can only occur in true connection. And the other thing she said, which I thought was interesting, is that it keeps us out of our self-awareness. That we use these devices to increase our distraction so that there's never a dull moment. So that we're never bored. So that we never have to ask any questions about ourselves. We can often be off and running and plotting further entertainment through these devices. And she said that using these devices and keeps the questions that we ask each other and ourselves very superficial. Well, I don't remember how many words in a tweet, but they're not very many, you know, so they have to be very superficial, you know, very simple, everything simplified down, and the exchange has to be equally as simple, so you don't really touch any depth in communication. Not as if you were sitting down and having a real heart-to-heart with somebody. You don't ever reach that kind of depth of connection through technology. And so, and the more we invest in that, the more superficial and distracted we become, which is her point, and the more inflated we become, because we keep ourselves away from quiet and full of noise, because we are using it as a distractive, for distractive reasons. So you get a sense that the technology, although convenient and certainly available, may not be serving our deepest needs. And I think we need to take stock of that. We need to really look at how we're using it. And, you know, somebody, a friend of mine, has an iPad, and he keeps telling me, you know, I should get an iPad. And I look at it, and I think, well, that's neat. Well, that's really neat. And I could do that. That's really cool. And I could do that and that. And I could take it here and there. And I could do this. And so, so he's telling me about all this. So I'm convinced. And then he walks out of the door with his iPad, and I don't want it. And I don't know what happened. Because I did really want it while he was telling me all that. It's just that there's something in me that says no to that. And it's not a righteous no. It's not in any way a stubborn no. I'm not going to do that. It's just like, no, you know, my heart's moving in a different direction than to be hooked in that way. So each of us, I think, have to come to our own decision about our use of technological innovations, but whether they're helping us, whether they're helping us meet the spiritual direction that our heart yearns for. Are we moving towards more quiet? Are we? You see, is your spiritual direction towards more quietude, towards more stillness, towards more silence? I mean, I can keep you entertained, and this is the reason that I don't. No, there's a lot of reasons I don't. One is I'm not an entertainer. But there are Dharma teachers who can keep you entertained. They can keep you, you know, storytelling and all of that. And you'll be you would enjoy it. You would enjoy it. You'd walk out of there, and I'm sure we could fill this room several times over if I changed my style. But we'd be missing something, because that's not really the way it points. And my job is to keep you on your edge, not to make it conveniently easy for you. And so sometimes that requires sort of just the raw truth of it all, rather than a lot of storytelling. And yet storytelling is fun, you know, you share in the common humanity where the stories are pointing, but there's also a common humanity in where silence points. And we miss that if we only know it from the point of view of storytelling or noise. We don't realize how silence, how stillness brings us down to the common level in which all of our hearts are immediately accessible. You can think of Dharma practice as kind of like an elevator moving down to different floors. The first floor that most of us travel, it's just to get familiar with the inward noise and working and emotions of our lives so that we see we don't have to take them as personally or as with as much conflict that we've done. And so we begin to quiet. From the first time we begin to quiet. We begin to have a renewed relationship with ourselves. Instead of this one in which we just bark at ourselves all day long, forcing ourselves, not understanding what's going on in here, but not being able to tolerate it at all, and all of the conflict and struggle that involves. The first floor down is some relief to that. But guess what? That's a quieter floor. We're now subterranean. Right? And then the next floor down is really an amazing descent itself, because instead of getting caught up in the individual differences that the first floor still contains, the next floor down we begin to see the commonality that which we share, what we have in common with one another, our humanity. And from the first floor down to the second floor down, prejudice becomes an abstraction. It becomes ridiculous. It doesn't even makes sense when you've gone too far down. It makes sense from the point of view of appearances. It makes sense from the point of view of contentiousness in my life and trying to keep your life distant from my life and me special to you. which is all noisy, which is all confrontive noise, but that first floor down solves that problem. As we get more tranquil and easier with our inward life, we begin to see the commonality of shared pain, the commonality of shared distress, and the commonality of shared humanity. But there's another floor down. There are many floors down, but I won't take you all the way to the next floor down, besides the commonality of the shared humanity, which is where metta is transporting us. Metta is finding that common hookup between ourselves and all the rest of humanity, and connecting with that and feeling the love intoned within that perception. The next floor down shows us the commonality of all of life, not just humanity. And here then becomes the ethics of killing. When you begin to see that life itself is commonly shared, then killing a mosquito makes as little sense to you as any other forms of killing. I'll take you down another floor. But each time we go, we are losing our need to differentiate. And therefore, we are becoming quieter. And this whole elevator drop is moving towards greater stillness. That's where this takes us. Before I get to the next floor down, though, I want to encourage people not to take the floor they're on and start demonstrating in relationship to it. Because what we're looking for often is a way to make it demonstrative, to speak out again, to make it loud, to make it contentious, to say you're not doing this, and if you had it together, you'd be... There will be a time when that comes naturally, but it won't be contentiously driven. But if you drop too quickly into some form of rebellion, because now you're seeing in a more true direction than you were seeing, and that presents all kinds of righteous indignation when you see, and nobody else is acting in accordance to what you're seeing, you can become very self-righteous and noisy. And you're really coming back up to the first level, although you feel like you've been changed forever. You haven't changed much at all. Okay, so I'm taking you down now. We're down to some floor. I can't remember. But just get a sense now, as we descend, that we have extracted our investment in appearances, differences from appearances, which is the most superficial and the noisiest level. I don't like your hair, your clothes aren't as good as mine, all of that stuff. To the sense of human being, the humanness in form. Whether it's a neutral person or someone that you don't know or do know, it doesn't make any difference. The common thread of humanity is there. And then we go down again, and suddenly it's no longer the formations of life where we are invested in, but life itself and all of its expressions and all of its forms. But there's still some noise, there's still some investment going on even at this floor. And the next floor down takes us out of investment entirely into presence, where awareness is the common thread to all things, rocks, sky, ground, is all held. Everything is held. in presence. And therefore the heart is completely freed of individuation, of particulars. That's a very quiet floor. But it's also a very true floor. Because each of these levels we have descended have come from insight, from the recognition of the way we have manufactured the difficulties to keep ourselves afloat. Because each time I say you're not, that by implications means I am. And therefore I keep self-inflating myself through the discord I have with appearances, with whatever it is that I'm in contention with. But not in presence. It's all released. And in presence, the investment in what kept us individuated and separate, thought, by definition, isn't as strong. In fact, it's almost non-existent. It doesn't mean that thoughts aren't occurring, they're just occurring within the space of that tranquility, in the space of that stillness. So all of those different descents were moving us deeper in relationship to our heart, the true connectedness of all things. That's what meditation, that's what all spiritual, authentic spiritual journey is supposed to do. But many of us use it in just the opposite way. We use it to have a greater sense of ourselves, a greater sense of our own accomplishment, of our own power of mind, of the beautiful appearances that are contained within the mind that many of us can discover. And unless we're constantly reminded with a tap on our shoulders almost daily, we will be lost in the entertainment of our own stories. Just as an accomplished meditation teacher can keep you entertained within the stories of Dharma. We have to keep our eye on the ball here, where we're going. Right? Is my life becoming quieter? Or, said in a crucial way, can I be quiet with this? Whatever this is, whatever I'm making into a problem, can I be quiet with this too? Therein lies the refuges. The refuge that I'm taking in the Buddha is the straight line of stillness that he depicts in whatever posture you see him. That's the mind-to-mind transmission that only a statue can convey. That's the representation of the stillness in us. Refuge in the Dharma is refuge in the non-resistant facts of life. Non-resistance is the underlying word. Because if there is resistance, there is noise. When life is just as it is, just as it's perceived, without any tension associated with what is being perceived, then it's quiet as itself. And that's taking refuge in the Dharma. Refuge in the Sangha is finding the commonality, not the discord, and honoring each one of our sense of authenticity. Letting each person alone to be themselves. That is rare to find, very rare to find in organizations. That we communicate almost effortlessly because we're all descending down to these deeper level floors, that communication energetically is communicated not often verbally, just in the willingness to open and listen to each other. So as the mind quiets, the heart opens. And it opens tenderly. It feels tender. I don't know how else to describe it. It's a word that many people misunderstand because it feels easily betrayed when you're that tender. And you feel like, you know, you're sort of losing your defense mechanisms. Which is true. You are being stripped of your defense mechanisms, which is bearing your heart. But that bearing of the heart is also accompanied by the capacity to hold whatever comes your way. So you're not at greater risk, you're at less risk. Because if somebody says something that's disturbing to you or tries to manipulate you, first of all, there's more awareness of that fact occurring. And secondly, you can hold their particular problem without making it your own. And so, yes, there's more tenderness, but it doesn't translate into vulnerability. And many people get stuck at that particular point because they feel they're getting more vulnerable and that they need more resolve and will and strength in order to navigate through the world. And so they pull back, they pull up from that particular floor. So this is the way we have transmitted the Dharma. We talk about bare attention. Not B-E-A-R, ferocious attention, but B-A-R-E, without anything, stripped of everything, bare attention. Because bare attention is the quietest attention you can give something. And therefore it will show you and reveal what is actually there and not your opinion or your reactions to what is being revealed. And therefore bare takes you down to the quietude, takes you to the level of quietude that we are seeking. And that's the first instruction you're given when you come to a meditation retreat or class. You can see that we, from day one, we have set a course for ourselves to move towards greater quietude. And yet that isn't understood by many people. We don't really know the direction our path is taking. And partly we're afraid of the silence, as I mentioned early on. It's disquieting. Quiet is disquieting. Feels like we're going somewhere that is not necessarily to our advantage. May I just encourage you to stay the course when you feel that way. Don't pull back in more noise. I can't tell you how often I see sincere Dharma practitioners creating their drama, their daily life's drama, over and over again. Just to have enough noise to recognize themselves. If your life looks like that, maybe you should look again at what you're seeing. Because maybe what you're perceiving as recognizing yourself is really at odds to the direction the journey takes. What you look like from presence is very quiet and very still. Add nothing to this experience. Let the fact be undefended. I'm just giving you little Dharma phrases that can sometimes be helpful. Remember, if you need some encouragement to work in this direction, that the big silence is waiting for us all. And why are we so afraid of death? It's because it doesn't contain anything that's recognizable. And so Dharma practice also begins to take us through our pretentious overlay to life, what we have made life to be that it doesn't naturally contain. In some ways, it follows the course of death. We die before we die, if we're lucky. One Zen master was asked, as he was with a student who was in her final days of life, she asked him, "How should I die? How should I go through what's inevitable?" And he said, "Die quietly." Don't make a big deal of it. It's just another floor. So I offer these suggestions for finding quiet. Finding quiet. First of all, don't look. Now I can go through the list. Because in your need to find it, you're just creating noise around it. Can I be quiet with this? Just to offer yourself a phrase from time to time. Can I be quiet with this? An emotion arises. Can I be quiet with this? What's so surprising is the amount of understanding that comes from the quiet. You don't get confused. All of these different conditioned ways that we have related to silence, hostility and distance and restraint and disagreement and confusion, all of that, those are just mind-generated reactions. The truth of silence is that it holds understanding, it holds awareness. Stillness and awareness are the same thing. Stillness equals awareness equals presence. And so the quieter I am, the more that is seen. The more that is seen, the more that is understood. The more intellect I use, the more narrow the focus, the noisier I become. And that noise blocks myself from real compatibility and interconnection. A key way to become quieter is facing pain. Being in and confronting, not confronting in terms of an antagonist, but just opening to the painful episodes, the painful emotions, the painful expressions of our life, without deflecting. Because it's the deflection that occurs, the noise that comes from the deflection. That's how we deflect, by denying its existence, or by turning away in resistance, or by reacting to. But by letting in the fact of the pain means that we have to become quiet with it. And that is helpful at every level of our descent. Learning to listen. There's something truly beautiful in our willingness to receive someone else, the thoughts, the presence, the connection of someone else. It's available to us many times during the day, and it's absolutely a pure form of meditation if you do it right. But how many of us really encourage true listening? And here's a way to show that we're moving away from quiet. If your practice is dry, if there's dryness, if it feels brittle, if it feels self-compelled, if it's like you're self-made, it'll feel very dry to you, mechanical. That's an indication that we're not moving in relationship to quietude, and that we're forcing, we're leaning into the journey instead of just, okay, what is here now? So we return everything to nothing. That's the way of quiet. Everything to nothing. The natural state of the universe is the state of nothing. Okay, y'all. Thank you. So we'll sit for a minute or two. So I was attending a Tibetan on how to move out of one's life at the moment of death. I was attending a series of lectures on that, and the Tibetan Rinpoche talked about the life force being forced out the top of your head, or he had some way of doing that. I said, you know, that feels like a lot of effort to me. What about just being quiet with it? Well, he says, that's the best, he said. So that's the fast track. Okay, so any questions or discussion points or anything you'd like to ask? Right. So the question is that she gets a sense of how, quieting the mind, seeing the thoughts, take you in a direction of quietude, but that it still feels like all the arrows are coming into you. So here's what happens. Okay. There's me listening to, right? I am listening to. The pure presence is in the listening. The medium through which information is being accessed. Right? Bare attention is when I stay out of that seeing, that looking, that hearing, and I just let it reveal. Now there's very little intrusion of me in the field by stirring things up. You see? So the purer we get the listening, the seeing, the hearing, right, the less interference we have with that. That's the first thing. The second thing is that what we begin to notice is the me that is listening is the judgments I have about what I hear. And as I catch that, as I begin to become aware of all of the little sounds I'm making back here and judgments I have about what is being seen, and I get a sense of that occurring, and I realize that that's interfering with clear seeing, I no longer invest much attention into it, and it gets quieter. And now it's just seeing, no longer me seeing that. Presence is the seeing. Okay? So it's not what we're seeing, it's not the object we're seeing, it's the actual act of seeing, the actual act of hearing. And as we begin to decipher what we're bringing into our seeing, and that gets quieter, then the seeing becomes much more obvious and more easily accessible. In fact, it's what remains when we have cleaned up the background noise, and surprisingly, the background noise is what created the foreground object. And so as I get quieter, the background noise goes, but so does the foreground object. I don't know what I'm seeing in terms of the details and memories associated with it. And then there is just the seeing, just the hearing. Does that make a loop? Okay, so that's the way this moves. Okay, so she's saying that it feels very frustrating, hard to do it again and again and again and again. Okay, right? If I could give you a different option, I would. But it's because you do it again and again. There's value to the repetition of doing it over and over again. So it's a close race between our frustration level and seeing deeply enough where we're no longer investing in that thing which causes the frustration. At some point, this one wins out. So don't give up just because it's hard. In fact, we're not asking you to do much except to be aware of what's going on. That's what is required of us, not doing something about what's going on, just being aware of what's going on, which is a different form, right, of invested energy. So it's not like this, because if I'm going like this, that's what's going on. It's like that. Right? But because the normal state of ourselves is contraction rather than expansiveness, it feels hard to come out of contraction because it's like living, you know, kind of in a knot your whole life and being asked to relax. What do you mean relax? It's like, you know, but relaxation is the natural state, right? And so we don't know really, we haven't found our way into relaxation. We haven't uncovered the formula for that authentic life. And that's what makes it seem so hard, is that we keep recalling back in contraction. But if you keep marching it forward, no one is denied access to it. Okay? Remember that. In your deepest frustration, remember that. Yes? Let me move the lamp here.
Right.
I can't hear that last part.
And then it also gratifies.
Yeah. Well, let's normalize the word karma so it doesn't. Her question is, you know, how does karma fit into this level of deep interconnectedness and interconnection? Karma is just a condition, is another word for conditioning. It's what we have, how we have learned to interpret what's in front of us. It's the background past that is being invested in what I'm currently seeing. It's what I remember, my reactions, all of that. So you make it very clear what karma is. It's not some outside force that we don't. It's our conditioning. It's what we have invested in for the meaning and for the depiction and identification of things. So then when we have that understanding and we feel reactive, we feel the karma coming forth, the job is not to invest more conditioning into that, but to be quiet with it. Can I be quiet with this too? And that extracts the energy of our reaction into that which holds the reaction, that which sees the reaction, that which feels the reaction. And so when you have divested all the energy in that particular expression of conditioning, that conditioning will end. It extinguishes itself. Karma then ends. Right? So that's the way this takes care of that. Don't think of karma as, you know, I walk outside and I get struck by lightning. That was my karma. That's too ambiguous how all that works. And it's not clear. But if you stay inside with yourself and see it as the way I have learned to behave and see and operate in this life, and the way my mind works to form the objects of my life and to have reactions within my life, then it's very manageable. It's very, very obvious. Okay, all. Thank you for your attention tonight. Thank you. We have some announcements. If everyone would hold their seat.